Speaker on this panel is someone who I've known for many years, Judge Stephen Markman. He personally exemplifies the separation of powers. He's currently on the Michigan Court of Appeals, a judge there, so there's the judicial branch. He served for several years as U.S. Attorney for Michigan. He worked as chief counsel for Senator Hatch on the Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution, thereby the legislative. He worked as assistant attorney general in the Reagan administration, thereby the judicial. I'm wondering, I think he may take a job sometime soon or later, sometime on in the press, at which stage we will know that, in fact, the press is a fourth branch of government. Steve has, Steve has also played a role back when he was in the Reagan administration. Well, I should actually deny something here on his behalf. Steve is actually not responsible for the appointment of Judge Baer. It is true that Steve was involved in judicial selection. But he was involved in judicial selection before that. He was he's involved in things in various appointments that were rated, qualified or barely qualified or partially unqualified by the American Bar Association. But Judge Baer, who was rated well qualified by the American Bar Association, Steve actually says he didn't have anything to do with that since it was in a more recent administration. Anyway, please welcome Steve Markman.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I think that was a nicer introduction than one I received shortly before I left the prosecutor's office as the U.S. Attorney in Michigan when I was introduced by the moderator as being one of the finest prosecutors that money could buy. I think the moderator's heart was in the right place. He also introduced my wife, who was on the dais with me, as one of the finest ladies to walk the streets. I'm sure my wife felt much the same way, but it's an honor to be here on this very distinguished panel. It would be my guess that a significant number of the inmates at the Jackson State Prison in Michigan who watched the O.J. Simpson trial, assuming that they were fortunate enough not to have been in solitary confinement at the time, harbored the thought that had they too been able to enlist the services of the Dream Team, they would not be in Jackson State Prison. One of the lessons that we are supposed to have learned from this decade's trial of the century is that the well-heeled receive a different measure of justice than do the poor. Perhaps because I'm a contrarian in these matters, I take away a much different lesson from the trial. Perhaps the O.J. Simpson trial is a judicial Rorschach test of sorts. But what I draw instead from the trial is that as lawyering becomes an increasingly critical factor in determining the outcome of the criminal trial, the well-heeled receive an increasingly different measure of justice than do the poor. And to make the antecedent point, as the procedures of the criminal investigation and trial become increasingly complex and focused upon issues which go beyond merely determining whether the defendant is committed the acts with which he is charged, lawyering becomes a more and more critical factor in determining the outcome of the trial. And as lawyering becomes an increasingly critical factor in determining whether equally culpable individuals will be incarcerated or go free, the sense of moral responsibility which necessarily underlies the criminal law, in my judgment, is diminished. As the connection between criminal conduct and punishment is attenuated, and as transactional factors such as the quality of lawyering become increasingly significant, I believe that the foundations of the criminal justice system are called increasingly into question by both the criminal perpetrator and by the public. The criminal, who tends to define justice largely in terms of equality or uniformity of treatment, comes to resent that others no less responsible for wrongdoing than himself go free, while the public, which tends to define justice on the basis of just deserts, is also resentful of the wrongdoer who goes free. both the criminal and the public perceive that when lawyering matters more, it is not typically because the better lawyer is able more effectively to demonstrate the weakness of the evidence against his client than the lesser lawyer, but rather because the better lawyer is able to take greater advantage of non-evidentiary factors. And such non-evidentiary factors are perceived as being more arbitrary and capricious than factors of evidence, as well as less closely related to the proper pursuits of the criminal justice system. Lawyering has become an increasingly important factor in the criminal justice system over the course of the past 30 years. Principally, I believe that this has occurred as a function of the increasingly arbitrary and capricious treatment of evidence. As Jeremy Bentham once observed, evidence is the basis of justice. To exclude evidence is to exclude justice. Over the course of the past 30 years, the American criminal justice system has developed a system of rules that reflects a pervasive willingness on its part to exclude from the consideration of the fact finder reliable and probative evidence. As a result, in Bentham's words, justice has been excluded. In compromising evidence, the search for truth has been compromised. Obvious as it seems, the discovery of truth is essential to the successful operation of the criminal justice system, at least one which is predicated upon a sense of moral accountability. To bring the effects of the system into play, its incapacitation and deterrence and punishment and rehabilitation, as well as to protect innocent people, the system must, of course, be able to accurately identify the perpetrators of crime. Compromises of the truth-seeking function are destructive of the system because they make the system less accurate in this identification. Mistakes in one direction will falsely brand innocent people as criminals and punish them unjustly, while mistakes in the other direction will deprive the public of protection from the offender, encourage others to think that they too can get away with crime, and impair the healing process for the victims of crime and those who survive them. If truth cannot be discovered and acted upon, the system can only fail in its constitutional mission of ensuring the domestic tranquility. And increasingly, I believe the system is failing in that mission. Although I would note that there are many who think that the pursuit of truth is less important than the pursuit of procedural rights. As one professor recently suggested, justice in the sense of finding the truth is for God, not worldly courts. What are some of the ways, however, in which the criminal justice system has been transformed over the past generation and a half, and in which its underlying premise of moral responsibility and the search for truth eroded? As a member of the court in Michigan, a state beset by extraordinarily high levels of violent crime, I routinely see cases in which a defendant seeks to deny the jury the benefit of evidence which everyone would agree tends to make more likely or even quite certain that the defendant has committed the crime with which he is charged. This is routine. This is, of course, the result of the exclusionary rule first introduced as part of the Constitution in 1961. When defendants prevail in invoking the rule, and they have sometimes prevailed even in my own opinions, since the rule is the law of the land, the result is that an individual whom we know to be a criminal goes free. He goes free because the jury, the fact finder, must be misled concerning the facts in support of the defendant's guilt. Is this consistent with the American people's sense of moral responsibility? I think not. If Johnny peeks into his sister Mary's diary and learns that Mary has been smoking at her girlfriend's house contrary to their parents' wishes and tells his parents about this, Johnny will deservedly be punished, but Mary will not continue to be free to go back to her girlfriends as if nothing had happened. On the court, I also routinely see cases in which a defendant has succeeded in suppressing evidence and thereafter argues his constitutional right to offer witnesses to the jury who will testify in a manner utterly inconsistent with the evidence which has been suppressed, as if the evidence never existed at all. In such cases, not only has the court succeeded in deceiving the jury concerning the defendant's guilt, but it is also complicitous in exposing them to clearly perjure testimony. As if Mary could deny to her parents altogether that she had a diary in which she said anything at all. On the court, I routinely see cases in which a defendant argues that the jury must not be apprised of the fact that the alibi which defendant offered at trial was not offered when he was arrested, was not offered when he was questioned by the police, and was not offered at any time during his pretrial confinement. In other words, that the alibi was first offered at the trial. Is this consistent with the people's sense of moral responsibility? Would the father who has come home from a hard day's work not find it curious that Johnny, who's been punished in his room all day by his mother for taking a forbidden piece of cake, has waited until his father's arrival home to allege for the first time that he was not in the kitchen when the piece of cake was taken? On the court, I also routinely see cases in which a defendant argues that the jury has unconstitutionally taken into account his silence, a silence in the face of charges against him upon arrest or in the courtroom, a silence which is contrary to the normal reaction of an innocent person when he's accused of misconduct. Another defendant argues that the prosecutor's arguments to the jury in his trial that certain evidence offered was unrefuted is reversible error because the only person who could have refuted that evidence was the defendant and he chose to remain silent. This too is argued to be unconstitutional. On the court, I routinely don't see cases that I would in a more rational system because of the devastating but often unrecognized impact of the Supreme Court's decision in Miranda in 1965. The greatest damage wrought by Miranda does not come when police occasionally forget the famous warnings required by the decision and when good confessions are suppressed, although that happens regularly. Rather, the greatest damage for Miranda is wrought when the police comply with its warnings and thereby discourage confessions. The impact of Miranda has been to seriously erode the supply of confession evidence that was once available in the criminal justice system but is available no longer. Miranda has created an environment in which confessions are affirmatively discouraged in contrast to the normal impulse of right and wrong on the part of people to tell the truth. Miranda insulates effectively criminal suspects from any questioning whatsoever through the introduction of the defense counsel at the earliest possible stage of the process. Defense counsel trained in law school one to tell their clients not to say anything at all, to shut up. It is also a very important premise of Miranda that the system be structured in a manner designed to ensure that the suspect not provide evidence that is inadvertently incriminating. But this is an odd, not to say a dangerous, view of the world. As a much earlier Supreme Court once remarked, the Constitution is not at all offended when a guilty man stubs his toe. On the contrary, it is decent to hope that he will. The moral instincts of most decent people are to celebrate self-inflicted injuries on the part of criminal suspects, not to seek to create a situation in which everything possible is done to avoid these circumstances. Such self-inflicted injuries enable us to punish wrongdoers while avoiding the possibility of punishing innocent persons. The moral instincts of most people is to celebrate when a greater degree of justice is achieved through police methods which do not involve coercion. Miranda is sharply in contrast to that moral instinct. As a result, at least 100,000 confessions each year are withheld from the criminal justice system, confessions which, by and large, would have been available to the system before Miranda. And as a result, substantive justice is denied to we the people in that same number of cases. On the court, I routinely see cases in which a defendant argues that inculpatory statements which he made to a confidential informant after he had been charged should be withheld from the jury because the police should not be able to continue their investigation at that point unless the defense counsel is present to tell the suspect to keep his mouth shut. The Supreme Court in the Messiah decision, in effect, created a new constitutional right not to be questioned about pending charges prior to trial except in the presence of an attorney. As with Miranda, the cost of Messiah is the invisible cost of confessions and inculpatory statements that once might have been but are no longer. On the court, I often see cases in which it is argued that past conduct on the part of a criminal defendant has impermissibly been considered in ascertaining whether he has committed the current offense with which he has been charged. This, too, in my judgment, is at odds with traditional notions of morality and common sense. That a defendant has committed seven previous rapes of a particular sort, it is true, is not dispositive that he is the culprit behind the eighth rape of a similar sort. It is, however, a factor that a reasonable juror might well find relevant. In our everyday lives, most of us do take such facts into consideration in judging people and drawing conclusions about circumstances. That Johnny has repeatedly taken cookies from the cookie jar in the past is not proof that he did so on the current occasion, but it is not irrelevant either in this determination. It is ironic that the principal rationale for the jury system, being its introduction of the community's sense of judgment into the determination of criminal guilt and innocence, that we would increasingly structure our system as we have in a way which denies the jury the opportunity to exercise reasonable judges and draw reasonable inferences from the facts while substituting judicial rules which are in conflict with those judgments and inferences. And this is only a sampling of the larger problem, ladies and gentlemen. The growing arbitrariness of the system and its divergence from the moral sense of the people and its disregard for evidence is also reflected, I believe, for example, in capital punishment hearings designed to assess aggravating and mitigating circumstances in which the impact of a crime upon its victims and the victim's family is sharply limited. In habeas corpus procedures, which allow defendants repeated appellate opportunities until witnesses die or witnesses' memories fade, and which enable defendants to avoid ever having finally to reconcile themselves with their misconduct, which I think is the first step toward any kind of genuine rehabilitation. This phenomenon is reflected in jury selection procedures designed to ensure the selection of the least informed panel possible. In Byzantine and interminable debates in the courtroom over what and how evidence will be presented to the jury, in the tolerance of defense counsel seeking to discredit testimony which it knows to be truthful, and in the increasingly prevalent appeals to race, class, and other irrelevancies in the courtroom. What all of these policies and procedures have in common is that they enhance the importance of the lawyer in the outcome of the criminal trial. They introduce factors in the outcome of the trial that have little to do with whether the individual on trial is or is not responsible for criminal wrongdoing. They are all contrary to the moral sense and common sense, I believe, of most of the American people, and they have resulted, in the words of Justice White in his dissent in Miranda, in some unknown number of cases of killers, rapists, and other criminals being returned to the streets and to the environments which produce them to repeat their crimes whenever it pleases them. In addition, what all of these policies have in common, or virtually all of them have in common, is that they were not a part of James Madison's Constitution. Virtually all of these policies and practices were incorporated into the Constitution during a relatively brief and aberrational time in the mid to late 1960s and early 1970s. It is beyond debate that a revolution in criminal procedure has taken place over the past 30 years. While observers may differ on the merits of this revolution, it can hardly be argued that the revolution has not had an effect. Alterations of the rules of a system or alterations of the rules of a game do have consequences, both in terms of being a contributing factor in the skyrocketing level of violent crime in the United States over this period, and in terms of separating the criminal justice system from the moral sense of the American people. This particular revolution, the criminal procedure revolution, has had enormous consequences. The system is one which deserves the violent criminal perpetrator by enabling him to avoid a personal accounting for his sins, instead enabling him to point to an often arbitrary criminal justice system instead as a scapegoat. And at the same time, the system deserves everyone else by its seeming indifference about protecting the people from known criminal perpetrators. As government has grown larger and larger, taking upon itself more and more functions and more responsibilities which are increasingly unauthorized by the Constitution, it is ironic that government has done a poorer and poorer job of carrying out its first function at all, the function for which governments are created for in the first place, the protection of the citizenry from domestic predators. If there is a silver lining, ladies and gentlemen, in the repellent O.J. trial, it is that for the first time in a long while, an exclusive preserve of lawyers and judges has been opened to public view. And most Americans, I'm convinced, did not like what they saw. They did not admire its tendency to exclude justice. They did not like what had become of a system designed to provide for their security and their tranquility. Perhaps as a result, if we are fortunate, and if there is the leadership, that experience will generate serious debate on what is different about the criminal justice system today than 30 years ago, and how to restore that system, a system that was both more compatible with the sense of right and wrong of the people and more effective in satisfying the fundamental mission of any criminal justice system. Thank you very much.